You're listening to Back in the USSR.
Да здравствует 60-я годовщина Великой Октябрьской социалистической революции. Да здравствует героический советский народ и его доблестные вооруженные силы. Слава Коммунистической партии Советского Союза, руководящей и направляющей силе советского общества. Ура!
Listening to Back in the USSR here on CFRU 93.3 FM's I'm Siegfried. And you see what I did there? I played the Soviet national anthem and the Palestinian national anthem back to back to kick off the show. because this week we're continuing our discussion of the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and an end to the system of Israeli colonial apartheid in historic Palestine. If you recall, last week I played an interview that I did a few years ago on American sociologist Al Szymanski and his book Human Rights in the Soviet Union. And one of the main things he talks about in that book is how the USSR treated national minorities and how it effectively abolished the national oppression that had been the norm suffered by many peoples under the old Tsarist Russian Empire. And it actually puts things in perspective that the Palestinian people would have in fact enjoyed far more freedom and far greater rights as a minority in the Soviet Union than they currently do as a majority in their occupied and colonized homeland. I've previously touched on the role that the Soviet Union itself played in supporting the Palestinian liberation struggle during the Cold War years. And indeed, the dominant narrative in the U.S. media during the 1980s Reagan administration was that Moscow was the font and source of practically all terrorist activity in the world. You know, that was the mythology of the time that was propagated through the press and whatnot. Of course, this was at the same time as the U.S. and its proxies were slaughtering tens of thousands of people in Central American countries like El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, while the CIA was in the process of creating the modern jihadist movement in order to destabilize and overthrow the socialist government of Afghanistan and its Soviet backers. And of course, the terrorists, quote unquote, that the Soviet Union was backing, they were in reality the progressive anti-colonial and national liberation movements throughout the Third World, notably including the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, and the African National Congress, ANC. Both of which were considered terrorist organizations by the U.S. government at the time. Just as people like Nelson Mandela and Yasser Arafat were considered terrorist leaders because they wanted real self-determination for black South Africans and Palestinians respectively. And were willing to work with the Soviet Union, Cuba, Libya, East Germany, and other socialist states to achieve their goals in the face of Western hostility. And that Western hostility continued throughout the Cold War, and frankly has not vanished now if you see the policy of most Western countries towards the Palestinians. It's either, you know, outright hostility as in terms of what the Trump administration's doing, or it's basically just cloying, patronizing nonsense, ultimately. You know, maybe a few good word here and there when it comes to the UN and like maybe criticizing Israeli settlements, but no concrete action, really, from Western countries. The hostility continues to this day when it comes to the West and the Palestinians. Now, the Palestinian struggle during the Cold War years was quite different from the Palestinian struggle today in the 21st century because it was taking place on wholly different terms in a very different world. In the era before the Oslo Accords in 1993, which of course I've talked about in previous shows, you know, the Oslo Accord, which really paved the way for the quote-unquote two-state solution and the so-called peace process and all the and the roadmap to peace and all the stuff that's happened since then, which really has just led the Palestinians down the road to just being boxed in smaller and smaller cul-de-sacs of territory in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, hemmed in by Jewish-only settlements and under occupation, under increasingly tight control by the Israeli military and subjected to Israeli military law and whatnot. You know, it just increased the occupation, tightened the occupation, increased the oppression. But before the Oslo Accords, before 1993, and especially before the fall of the Soviet Union, the Palestinians had multiple strong allies who were willing to back their cause materially as well as politically. You know, it wasn't just through diplomacy. It wasn't just through UN votes. It was through actual material assistance. You know, there were countries such as Syria, Iraq, and Libya, which were strong, independent Arab nationalist states at the time. And although disputes certainly did arise between them, they were all generally dependable in their support for the Palestinian cause during the Cold War years. The Soviet Union went far beyond providing diplomatic support and actually trained a whole generation of Palestinian leaders in its universities and military academies, and provided actual military support for Palestinian groups fighting Israeli occupation on the ground. And this situation changed entirely when the Cold War ended and this support disappeared. As I've talked about in previous shows, the Palestinian leadership lost a lot, if not all, of the leverage that it originally had vis-a-vis Israel. And its position would only get weaker as its Arab allies, like Iraq, Syria, and Libya, faced the cruel realities of a U.S.-dominated world, a U.S.-dominated world order, that would in fact spell destruction for many of them. I mean, Syria is the only one left standing today, and it's under siege and fighting for its life. While world public opinion remained firmly on the side of the Palestinians, and the U.S. and Israel were and still remain isolated at the U.N. when it comes to the Palestinian issue, the ability of states to provide real assistance to the struggle of the Palestinian people was dramatically curtailed with the end of the Cold War. With the end of the Cold War. With the negotiation of the Oslo Accords in 1993, the Palestinians had already lost a great deal. And this showed itself dramatically at the negotiating table, where the Israelis and their U.S. backers were now effectively holding all the cards. And they were going to be the ones who set the terms. While it had never been a level playing field ever between the Palestinians and the Israeli occupiers, nonetheless, with the diplomatic, political, and above all military balance of forces between the Palestinians and Israelis, they were shifted overwhelmingly in Israel's favor with the collapse of the USSR. It has to be said that during the Cold War years, when the Soviet Union and the Socialist Bloc countries were strong, it was possible to exert major pressure on occupying powers like Israel in Palestine and the UK in the case of Northern Ireland. And when real results through a combination of political pressure and armed struggle it was possible to really exert strong pressure, changing the situation on the ground, pushing for liberation. In the current era of U.S. global hegemony, this is no longer possible, although Palestinians must still engage in struggle, in many cases armed struggle, simply out of survival, particularly when the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, is willing to slaughter thousands of Palestinians in Gaza, almost at the drop of a hat. And it must be said that this resistance proved effective. I mean, Israel was not able to overrun Gaza with a ground invasion or assert the kind of control it wanted to assert in its bloody assaults, through its bloody assaults on the Gaza Strip in 2009, which was Operation Cast Lead, and in 2015, which was Operation Protective Edge. Israel was not able to gain the kind of control it wanted over Gaza because it would have meant unacceptable losses. Both in terms of soldiers and in material, in military equipment. It would have been unacceptable. So as small scale as it might be, the Palestinian armed groups in Gaza still possess a real deterrent, which prevents their total colonization by Israel. But it has to be said that during the Cold War years, that deterrent was far larger, and the Palestinians did have like a far greater strength. You know, far more allies, far more leverage than they do now. And now, of course, they are fighting for survival. You know, they've been reduced to fighting for survival as opposed to pushing for actual, you know, victories. And pushing for full liberation. Now they're just fighting for survival. I'm going to play an interview with Norman Finkelstein a little while later on the show, which delves further into this. But right now I want to continue with the show's coverage of the case of Ahed Tamimi and the 16-year-old Palestinian girl's struggle against the Israeli occupation of her village and her people in the West Bank. I mean, just as it has done with thousands of Palestinian activists like her, the Israeli state is doing its best to demonize this girl and what she stands for. You know, because she, of course, has stood up. The soldiers stood up to soldiers trying to invade her home. As I've mentioned in past shows, she's currently being detained and treated horribly by the Israeli security forces, who snatched her from her home under cover of darkness. But she remains unbowed and really has become a symbol, an international symbol of Palestinian resistance and defiance in the face of this horrible occupation they are subjected to. You know, they still refuse to bow down. And indeed, they will never surrender, I think it's safe to say. So this is the report that Abby Martin of Telesur did on Ahed this past week on the Empire Files. I'm going to play that now. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
بس انا بخاف على اهلي انه يموتوا بخاف اخسر حدا من اللي بحبهم يعني اصحابي كل اهلي بالبلاد هاي معرضين كلنا انه نموت باي لحظه يمكن هسه انا اشوف جندي جاي يقتلني.
Recently, the struggle for Palestinian human rights gained international attention surrounding a new icon of resistance, 16-year-old Ahed Tamimi. On December 15, a video of Tamimi slapping an Israeli soldier outside of her home went viral. But what isn't seen on the video is that just moments before, Israeli forces shot her 15-year-old cousin Mohammed point blank in the face with a rubber bullet, causing severe internal bleeding. A few days later, Ahed was violently arrested in the middle of the night in a raid by dozens of soldiers. Ahed's 20-year-old cousin, Noor, her aunt, Manal, and Ahed's mother, Nariman, have since been arrested. Her mother, Nariman, has been charged with aggravated assault and incitement for uploading the video of her daughter on social media. And just days into 2018, the first Palestinian teen killed by Israeli forces in the West Bank was Ahed's other cousin, Musa'ab Tamimi. He was shot at close range by soldiers raiding their village. Ahed's arrest and imprisonment by the Israeli army has drawn ire from the international community and attention to the brutal military occupation, in particular its treatment of children, up to 700 of which are processed through Israeli military courts every year, some as young as 12. Today, Ahed is in jail awaiting trial. Israel has slapped her with 12 different charges, including assaulting a soldier. Some of the charges are for incidents years ago, including stone throwing, a crime for which Israel recently increased the maximum penalty for to a 20-year prison sentence. While in the West Bank in late 2016, I visited the small village where the Tamimi family has lived for generations. We're here in Nabe Saleh, a village under occupation by Israeli forces. At the entrance to the village is a military outpost, and on their land is a large illegal settlement. Their main water source is a spring that's been appropriated for the settlers. This is one of four villages that have been holding protests every Friday for several years. But just this month, they've decided to stop in order to re-strategize. You can still see the remnants of that struggle. Everywhere you'll find used munitions, just like this one. Images of unarmed protesters being horribly abused, especially children, have made this place known as an epicenter of Israeli brutality and Palestinian resistance. I visited the Tamimi family at their home. As many children in Palestine, Ahed's wisdom shined clear beyond her years and showed why her voice is such a threat. Many children don't worry about much. They spend their time playing with their friends, but your childhood has been littered with Israeli soldiers harassing, brutalizing your friends, your family, your village. Can you talk about what that's been like?
يعني أكيد الإشي بأثر سلبي علينا بس إنه إحنا مجبورين إنه نتأقلم مع الوضع إنه طبعاً مش راح نقدر نتعود بس لازم نجبر حالنا إنه نتأقلم مع الوضع لأنه اللي يعني أنا لو بديش يعني صح أنا بخافش إنه أموت وبخافش من الموت بس أنا بخاف على أهلي إنه يموت وبخاف أخسر حدا من اللي بحبهم يعني أصحابي كل أهلي يعني بالبلاد هاي معرضين كلنا إنه نموت بأي لحظة يمكن هسا أنا أشوف جندي جاي يقتلني يعني الإشي بأثر علينا يعني كثير أوقات كنا نلعب نلاقي الجيش فايتين يخرب كل شيء كثير أطفال بيكونوا طالعين على المدارس والحواجز مسكرة بيضطروا يرجعوا في كثير أطفال يكونوا حابين مثلا رايحين على الملاهي يعني الحواجز بتتسكر راجعين من حفلة وبكون حاجز مسكر بيخرب كل اللي فرحناه قبل بالحاجز يعني إيشو صعب كثير وبتمنى إنه ما حدا يعيشه وبتمنى إنه إحنا نخلص منه كمان.
How do you deal with this psychologically as a child?
ما يعني فلسطين بعرفش الولد يعني بيخلق من هو صغير قادر يتأقلم مع الأمور هاي بعرفش كيف يعني إيشي بنحكاش يعني اللي مش عايش ومش راح يقدر يفهم.
What is your necklace? Where did you get these bullets from?
أكيد هانسن سألك الرصاصات هذول من جبتيهم.
هذول الرصاصات اللي بنلاقيهم بعد ما جيش يطلع من البلد بنلمهم بنصلع بدل الموت حياة بنعمل فيهم شكل حلو بنعمل فيهم يعني إشي زي ما هم بيجوا بقتلونا فيهم إحنا بنحولهم لإشي مفيد إلنا إشي نتسلى فيه هدول الرصاصات كانوا لخالي اللي استشهد وابن خالي الثاني أعطاني إياهم هدية.
The mainstream coverage of her arrest has omitted the context of the ongoing tragedy plaguing her hometown. Nabi Saleh is a small Palestinian village with under 200 residents. It is completely surrounded by occupation forces, from dangerous checkpoints to permanent bases. In their village, Israeli soldiers are always watching, if not physically present. It is also governed by Israeli military law, which pretty much means occupation soldiers have the right to enter any home, close any street, and arrest or shoot any person, practices they employ with extreme frequency. In addition to the military, their village is flanked by huge, constantly expanding Israeli settlements, filled with its own militia of armed settlers. Under constant attack, the village spent years holding non-violent marches every week, despite guaranteed violence from occupation soldiers. Ahed's father, Bassem, has been a principal organizer. American media constantly says that Palestinians should protest peacefully, which you've been doing for years. What has the response been from Israeli forces?
The idea of the existence of Israel and the policy of Israel and the Israeli occupation army since the beginning of the Zionist movement does not recognize the existence of rights for the Palestinians on their land. Consequently, any practice from our side, Israel describes as violence. The Israeli reaction to Palestinian citizens is harsh because it does not want to see Palestinians present on Palestinian land. Therefore, it is the same reaction, whether Palestinians used armed resistance or nonviolent popular resistance, because Israel's policy is based on the false claim that Palestine was, quote, a land without a people for a people without a land. Therefore, all of Israel's policies are to expel Palestinians from their land, whether they resisted or whether they stayed at home, whether they did something or did not.
American and Israeli media also call anyone who initiates any sort of self-defense terrorists. Your response?
Israel has managed to distort the image of Palestinians and create a bad image for the world and the international community by linking the legitimate Palestinian struggle with terrorism. The definition of terrorism is a loose and rubbery definition. For example, real terrorism, like ISIS and Israel's ethnic cleansing, cannot be compared to the stone held by a Palestinian child in an attempt to restore his legitimate rights. The resistance to the occupier by all means is legitimate according to all international laws.
And there are a couple photos that went viral of your children being horribly abused by Israeli forces. Can you talk about this and also how common is this treatment of young children especially?
There is confusion and distortion regarding the participation of children in marches. The propaganda broadcast by Israel is that we are pushing our children to participate in marches because we do not like them or fear for them. This is a false accusation. It is illogical to push our children to participate while we know that the Israeli army does not differentiate between a small child and an adult. We know that the Israeli army does not know humanity and does not respect childhood. Therefore, no one can use his child to provoke the Israeli army. And I am sure that this is real slander. In fact, children participate in the marches because they are part of Palestinian society and live the same adult suffering. They suffer from cutting off of water. The Palestinian child gets water only 12 hours a week, same as adults. They suffer from gas bombs that they inhale just like adults. They suffer from imprisonment of their mother and father and other beloved people. They suffer from the confiscation of their land completely, just like adults. The Palestinian child lives in the same suffering as Palestinian adults. Second, there is no safe place to keep our children in. We tried once to put our children in a house to prevent them from going out to the marches. So the army threw tear gas bombs inside the house, and we were forced to remove them to save their lives. The Israeli occupation invaded my house more than 150 times during the last 5 or 6 years. So there is fear inside my children from this occupier, who is present in their lives on a daily basis. They have psychological complications. The psychological impact can be even more damaging to them.
Regardless of that trauma, Ahed's threat to occupation forces has clearly been that she shows no fear in the face of their violence. Because of this, Ahed is no stranger to public attention for her fearless defense of her family. In 2012, when she was only 11 years old, there was a viral video of her rescuing her mother from being arrested by soldiers. 3 years later, another viral video showed that same courage as she rescued her 12-year-old brother, Wahed, from being beaten and arrested by occupation forces. I spoke to both of them about that incident.
أنا وصحابي عن الجبل الجيش من ورانا صحابي هربوا هرب من عند الجيش وأنا نزلت عند الجيش اللي تحت كانوا في الشباب متحاصرين في النص نصهم هربوا وأنا هربت على جهة كان ابن خالي مسك ابن خالي في وقت هاي اللحظة بعدين أنا طلعت وما كنتش عارف إنه في جيش لسه فوق كنت عارف إني هربت منهم فنزل علي جندي بده يمسكني هربت منه فمساكن لما طلعت عن الحجار فبطحني وصار يخنق في وضرب وجهي في الحجار وكان اول حدا عندي وصل كان الصحافي وبنت عمي وصارت تنادى على النسوان اللي فوق تنزلوا نزلت امي واختي وعمتي وصار يضربن في الجندي فتفلت منه فامي اجت بتحكي لي انه واعد انا وقتها لما عرفت انه اخوي يعني انه ما تحملتش اشوفه هيك انه باخذه وانا مش عامله شيء نزلت من الجبل ها وطلعت على الجبل الثاني وبعدها وقفت صرت اصرخ للجيش انه تاخذه هو انه ما عامله شيء الولد صغير طبعا صاروا يضحكوا امي صرت احكي لهم انه تضحكوا هسه بس مش عارفين انه فلسطين راح تتحرر ونضحك عليكم وانتم طالعين منها
Israeli media has tried to dismiss Ahed's militancy as simply robotic training, but her mature worldview is better explained by how brutality from the occupation has been her entire life, ever since she was born. The Tamimi family has long been a target for their continued resistance and defiance in the face of sheer violence, torture, humiliation, and death. In addition to the recent murder of her cousin in the first week of 2018, when Ahed was only 11 years old, her cousin Rushdie Tamimi was killed by soldiers at a peaceful demonstration. And when she was only 10 years old, her cousin Mustafa Tamimi was killed at a protest when Israeli soldiers shot him in the head at point-blank range. A clear war crime. Her mother was also seriously wounded by an Israeli bullet, and her father nearly died from being tortured. While many of her loved ones had been stolen by Israeli bullets, many others had been stolen by Israeli jails. Ahed is just the latest in the Tamimi family to be imprisoned. In fact, the Tamimi family was jailed by British colonial forces before Israel was even created. Ahed grew up with her father, Bassem, in and out of prison for the crime of organizing peaceful demonstrations. Bassem, you yourself were arrested and tortured in Israeli prison. Can you talk about your treatment in detail and what happened?
I've been arrested in my life 9 times since the beginning of the First Intifada. Most of my arrests were administrative detentions. This detention, which has no legal status in any international law, is a copy of the British colonial experience, in which it practiced its terrorism and its unjust laws against the Palestinian people. The most difficult arrest for me was in 1993, where I was arrested with a group including my sister and my cousin. In prison, I experienced violent torture during interrogation. I've had many experiences being tortured, but that experience was the most difficult. They used a message called solution. The solution is to prevent nutrition from reaching the brain by not letting you move your head so the interrogator can control the detainee and take confessions quickly. But this method is very serious and very dangerous. After hours of interrogation, I felt faint and fell into a coma and found myself paralyzed in a hospital. When a soldier brought me a newspaper, I discovered that I had been in a coma for 10 days and I did not know what happened. Yes, I was in a coma for 10 days and completely paralyzed. I'm a single son for my family. When my parents were notified that I was in a state of clinical death, they made a poster for me, a sign of death, to declare martyrdom, meaning that I was practically ready for the funeral processions. They released me out of prison right after they killed my sister. I mean, the same day. When I got home, my sister was martyred 2 days earlier. My sister went to court to see her son, but was assaulted by a court employee who hit her and pushed her to the ground. Then she pushed her off the stairs, causing her to fall on her head, and she lost her life. This was the most difficult experience of that arrest. Maybe the most difficult experience in my life.
In your view, what is the viability of a two-state solution?
I think it's destroyed.
The two-state solution has been killed through settlement growth. Settlements have grown 5 times, multiplied fivefold, and the settler population has more than doubled since the Oslo Accords. The West Bank has been cut up through barriers, the wall, and control of all the natural resources in the West Bank. Thus, it is impossible to establish an independent Palestinian state on land occupied by Israel since 1967. Israel now controls 62% of the West Bank. Area C, where only 70,000 Palestinians remained, now there's 400,000 settlers, where Palestinians were displaced by the silent ethnic cleansing. For example, I own a house. The Israelis sent me a demolition notice for my house, meaning they could demolish it at any time. 2 months ago, they demolished a house nearby, and there are 11 or 13 houses that are threatened with demolition in my village of Nabi Saleh. They can destroy it at any moment. I cannot build a house for my son or daughter. So my 4 children will be deported because of this decision, sent out of Palestine. This is a silent ethnic cleansing. The problem is that the two-state solution in Israeli society is a product of the left-wing Israeli parties. The Israeli left has lost. In fact, there is no Israeli left-wing. The Israeli left is over. And therefore, the two-state solution cannot be assessed with the Israeli right. In Israel, no one talks about a two-state solution. Therefore, as Palestinians, we must not remain in the same position. We have to search for a new fighting strategy that achieves our goals.
As the Israeli government hopes to accelerate their colonial project under Trump, they seek to break the spirit of the youth-led resistance. But making an example of Ahed has backfired. Remaining proud and defiant, she's shown the world a face of heroism that Israel has long tried to bury. As well as the reality that's always ignored, the absurdity of a colonial state declaring any resistance a crime when it's against a military occupation that is itself illegal.
بحس إنه بدي أظل متمسك بالمواجهات وبالحق الأطفال الفلسطينية وبدي أظل مكمل قضيتي حتى تحرير فلسطين من جنود الاحتلال الإسرائيلي.
What do you want to see happen? What would make you happy and bring peace to you and your family?
أنا بتتوقع هي بتقدر تحرر فلسطين. يعني بتوقعش إنه في قضية الفلسطينيين بحكيش إنه قضية فلسطينية ولا قضية عربية. قضية فلسطين قضية إنسانية. يعني الإشي اللي بيسعدني أشوف كل يعني الإنسانيين بالدنيا يعني بتضامنوا معنا عشان نقدر نحرر أرضنا. يعني فيش إشي ثاني بالدنيا بتمنى غير هال إنه تتحرر فلسطين عشان إنه بس تتحرر فلسطين أنا بقدر وقتها أحقق كل شيء بتمنى لأنه مع وجود الاحتلال كل شيء ممنوع عني لا أنا ولا غيري بقدر إنه يعمل اللي أنا إنه أنا بفكر فيه. يعني مثلا بحلم إنه أعيش جنب بحر هي يعني بدها تدخلني على البحر أنا مرفوضة أمني يعني مع إنه صغيرة بس مرفوضة أمني بقدرش أفوت تركوني على الحاجز بطخوني. فيعني قضية فلسطين إنه ليش قضية إنسانية قبل ما تكون فلسطينية عربية وبس تحرر فلسطين أنا لحالي بقدر أحقق كل شيء مش بحاجة لحدا إنه يحقق شو بتمنى غير إنه فلسطين تتحرر.
Just screwed cause this word is misconstrued. Small countries exempt from food cause leaders have different views. You choose.
What mean the world to me is being free. Live and let live and just let it be.
Let it be.
Love, peace and harmony. One universal family. One God, one aim and one destiny.
Oh yeah. Imagine life without a choice at all. Giving a vote without a voice at all. These be the problems that we face. I'm talking poverty and race. But no matter what the case, we gotta
hold on to this feeling.
Candidate to hate had to beat on the drum to communicate for what was to come to those who were hung. They would decapitate the tongue if you would mention the word freedom.
Got people screaming free Bumia Jamal, but two out of three of y'all will probably be at the mall. I'm heated with y'all, the defeated will fall, incomplete and unsolved when the word freedom's involved.
Yo, my forefathers hung in trees to be free.
Rest in peace.
Got rid of slavery but still kept the penitentiary. And now freedom got a shotgun and shells with your name. Release the hot ones and let freedom ring.
I'm a former boat prisoner, Hollywood visitor. Dance for cats, segregated on wax. My color got me handy, Cap, Anus, and Andy. For the freedom, they just won't hand me.
Hold on to this feeling.
So true and it been hurting so long.
Feeling.
That's the reason why we named this song.
Freedom.
Cause it's not a lot of time. Your heart, body, soul, and your mind. It's so true and it been hurting so long.
Feeling.
That's the reason why we named this song.
Freedom.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. That was Jurassic 5 with Freedom. And just listen to the Empire Files, Abby Martin meets Ahed Tamimi. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that after the break. But we are going to take a bit of a break here on Back in the USSR, so please stay tuned.
You are listening to CFRU 93.3 FM, and boy, are you lucky.
Girls Rock Camp Guelph is back March 12th to the 16th, 2018. This unique experience provides female-identifying youth the opportunity to create a band, write music, learn how to play instruments, and perform it all live in 1 week of training. The outcome of the camp is more than just music. The campers feel empowered to be who they are, to be creative, and to bond and share that experience with their new friends. Applications and more information for this year's camp are available on our Girls Rock Camp Guelph Facebook page or email us at girlsrockguelph@gmail.com. Applications are due February 25th, 2018. Girls Rock Camp is physically accessible.
Aerobics. Gonna stretch your mind.
Your life.
Tuesday morning. Your life. 7 to 9. CFRU 93.3.
The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for people to help out with their music project. Studies have demonstrated overwhelming evidence of the beneficial effects of music and stimulation on people living with dementia. The Music Project provides a free-of-charge iPod with a personalized playlist to individuals living with dementia. The Alzheimer's Society of Waterloo Wellington is looking for volunteers to help with tech, iPod setup, and creating playlists. They are also looking for folks to donate old iPods, iTunes gift cards, or money. $75 gets an iPod Shuffle, and $150 gets an iPod Touch. Other MP3 players are also welcome. For more information or to get involved, visit alzheimerww.ca/musicproject.
I understand if there is something.
Listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. So, I'm going to carry on now. We're going to play another piece. This is from the interview from the Real News Network about dealing with Ahed Tamimi and her family. And in this case, interviewing a member of her family who has recently experienced prison, recently experienced, the repression, incarceration at the hands of the Israeli regime, at the hands of the Israeli occupation. And one of the things I really want to stress here, this is not about victimhood. Anti-imperialism is not about victimhood. It's about resistance. And that always needs to be stressed when we're talking about things like this. Because this can sound very, very grim. But one of the things that's very important to remember is through all this, you see the human spirit, that human spirit of resistance against oppression, against these forces which are really coming down on human lives in places like Palestine. These repressive forces, occupying forces, colonial forces. People are fighting back against that, even though the conditions of that struggle are far less favorable than they were in the 1980s. Back when they had strong allies. Now there's very few strong allies in the world today that the Palestinians can really count on. In this world that's mainly dominated by the United States, which of course is Israel's main ally, the occupier's main ally. This is a very difficult time to be a Palestinian. But they continue to fight. They continue to resist. And that spirit is something that needs to be celebrated, needs to be supported. That resistance needs to be allied with. There needs to be solidarity. And there is solidarity. There is BDS, the BDS campaign, which is going strong. More and more people are getting behind that. Boycotting Israel. Artists refusing to perform in Israel. academics refusing to attend conferences there, you know, or companies refusing to do business or what have you. You know, this is picking up steam. Just like the campaign to boycott South Africa, apartheid South Africa picked up steam. And of course, the resistance in South Africa was led by the ANC, African National Congress, which of course was also allied with the Soviet Union. You know, which backed national liberation movements throughout Southern Africa, in fact, fighting against colonialism. So it's this resistance that we're really focused on here. Okay, so I'm going to play the interview from the Real News Network about Ahad Tamimi's family. So please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
It's the Real News. I'm Aaron Mate. In recent weeks, people around the world have learned of Palestinian resilience through the plight of the Tamimi family in the occupied West Bank. For years, the Tamimis have led protests against the Israeli occupation and theft of Palestinian land. Then last month, 16-year-old Ahed Tamimi became a global symbol of resistance when she was arrested for slapping an Israeli soldier who was trespassing on her property. Just earlier, Ahed's cousin, Mohammed Tamimi, was shot in the face, leaving him in a coma. Ahed remains in an Israeli military prison and is charged with multiple counts of assault. Then last week, Israeli forces shot dead Ahed's 17-year-old cousin, Mossab Tamimi, at a protest in the West Bank. As he was laid to rest just before, Israel released another cousin, Noor Tamimi, on bail. Joining me now is Manal Tamimi. She was also arrested last week at a protest calling for her relatives' release. Welcome, Manal. Thank you so much for joining us. It's hard to know where to start, given how much has happened to your family. But let's start with your own case. You were arrested at a protest calling for the release of Ahed, Noor, and Ahed's mother. What happened to you?
First, I want to thank you for giving me the chance to talk about what's really going on with our family and in the village. Actually, what happened that we decided to make a women protest first in solidarity with Ahed and Naiman because they had the trial in Ofer prison, which is the only Israeli prison in the West Bank. And then also with the solidarity with the female prisoners in the Israeli prisons. After nearly 2 or 3 minutes of beginning the protest, actually we were still gathering, and suddenly they began to shoot tear gas at us. And one of the soldiers, she came to me and she asked me to go back. When I refused, she immediately arrested me without any justification or without even warning. And then they charged me that I tried to, I attacked this soldier and I was organizing illegal activity in a closed military zone.
And what happened to you after you were taken to prison, after you were arrested?
When she took me back to the prison and we were away from the media and the cameras, she began to beat me, and I had bleeding in the jaw that I all the time in the prison I was very sick, and I was under extreme pain. They took me to interrogation where they kept me the whole night until 12:30 at night outside in cold. They took me inside for interrogation. Then they took me back, kept me outside in the cold and without food, without water, without anything. And by the end of the interrogation, they sent me to Hasharon prison, where Nariman, Noor, and Ahd are there. I reached the prison around 4 in the morning. And after that, the trial began. I had 2 trials. I have to go back to Ofer prison, which is around 3 hours from Hasharon. Hasharon, it's in Netanya, inside Occupied 48, and the offer is in West Bank in the Ramallah area. Which, of course, just going to from one prison to another is a torture itself, because they put you in a bus made of cells, with metal chairs. You can't move without this cells is very small, that you can't move, and it's black without windows or anything. And they took us from Hasharon at 2:30 in the morning, and we were back at 12 at night. And the next day it's the same. At 2:30 in the morning, we have to leave to the court and go back at 12. So itself it's exhausted, and in the same time they in this buses during the taking us to the court, they put us with the Israeli criminals, men, not women, in the same place. So this is also where terrifying, because most of them are, where one of them, he was drunk and old, he was high, I think he had drugs or something, and he all the time he was trying to attack us, and it was so scary, and all the time we were terrified that one of them gonna attack us.
And as you were released, your cousin Masab Tamimi, he was shot dead in the occupied West Bank at a protest. He was 17 years old.
Yeah.
If I have this right, if I have this correct, he is the third member of your family to be killed by Israeli forces. Can you tell us about him, and were you able to go to his funeral?
Actually, Musad, he was killed while I was in prison. We were, I was back from the prison clinic, because I was very sick, and we were watching TV, and suddenly I saw him on the TV thing that Musab Tamimi, he was shot, killed. Of course, this is one of the most difficult experiences anybody could go through, to see your cousin and his blood on TV while you don't understand what's going on and what's happening, and you will think about the others, what happened with him. So then I was, at night I was released, and Mossad, he was an active young man. He has many dreams want to come true. He wanted to study. He was so clever. He was this kind of person who loved life to the end. And always he was. They used to live in Jordan, and they just came back to Palestine a few months ago. So he was so happy that finally he's in his country, in among his family, with his people, but a sniper, he shot him, and it was clear that it's assassination, it's not a random shooting. By the way, the bullet went in his neck. Of course, it's one of the difficult times we are facing with the attack. The arrest of the women, the attack at the village. But Musab, he's the third member of my family who's killed during the nonviolent resistance that we began in 2009. But actually, 22 Tamimi has been killed during the since 1976 until now, during the resisting the occupation.
Manal, can you tell us about that? These protests that your family has been involved in for years now against the Israeli theft of your land and water sources. This is not something that began recently, and this is something that goes on a weekly basis. Can you just explain to us, for people who aren't familiar with what your family has done to defend your land in the occupied territories?
Actually, we are resisting since the beginning of occupation, but our organized resistance, it began in the 9th of December 2009. After we lost two-thirds of the village land due to the settlement expansion. The settlement, it's called Halmish, and it's been built in 1976. After the settler took over a British police station since the British mandate. And since that time, they began to expand the settlement, and they began to steal land under different justification, either the natural expansion for the settlement or for declaring a state land or a closed military zone. So every time they change the excuse, but always it's about the shifting of the land. So in 2009, when they took the spring, we decided that we have to begin our non-violent organized the protest in the village. What we mainly wanted to do is to march toward the springs, and calculate the ants there, planting new trees, and just to ensure that this is a Palestinian land, not settled. But the Israeli response were very, very violent. They began to use different kinds of tear gas, which contain white phosphor, nerve gas, and other chemical substance. They began to use live ammunition, steel-coated bullets, the same kind that they shot Muhammad the day they 2 weeks ago, and he was so lucky that he survived. Also, skunk water, which is chemical substance mixed with water with a very bad smell, like did animals smell, and they tried to pollute did our water, the water tanks on the rooftops, because we already have problems with water. We only have 12 hours a week water. Since 2009 until now, the village counted 650 residents, 550 of them have been injured, and 215 have been arrested, including 44 child and 10 women. We have 12 demolition orders, and also 38 houses partially burned of gas canister. So all this, or this collective punishment for the village, just because of the choice of nonviolent resistance, just people who trying to march or express their opinion peacefully, children, men, women. So there's no need for such a force to stop us. Of course, the worst thing about this, that we had to lose, we lost Rushdie, who was 30 years old, and he has a 3-year-old daughter, Mustafa, who was 28 years old, and recently Mus'ab, who is 17. And another guy who was 18, he's from a nearby village, but he was shot killed in the village during one of the protests.
And Muhammad, your 15-year-old cousin, as you say, almost lost his life, was left in a coma. And let's hear from him. He recently spoke to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz in a video, and he told his story of what happened.
When we got to the villa, I stood up on the wall and I didn't know that the army was there. I didn't see a single soldier. And then the soldier shot me and I lost consciousness. They took us to Bait Rama Hospital nearby. They didn't know what to do with me and they didn't do anything. So they took me to a hospital in Ramallah where they operated on me for 6 hours. I didn't get up for a week afterwards because of the pain in my head.